Governor Sheffield gets a lot of credit for, over the last 2 years, helping us get to this point.
Former Governor Bill Sheffield steps down as director of the Port of Anchorage Project. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the EPA works on assessing the Bristol Bay watershed.
Frankly, it's not just about Pebble. We think that there's potential for a number of mines up there.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Bill Sheffield is stepping down from his post as director of the Port of Anchorage project. Sheffield outlined his plans in a letter to Anchorage city officials this week. Sheffield's retirement is effective on January 15th. The port director and former governor of Alaska made his announcement official in a letter to Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan on Wednesday. Mayor Sullivan made the announcement public at a press conference today, saying the 83-year-old Sheffield's retirement was entirely Sheffield's decision. Sullivan had high praise for the port director.
This has been really a 2.5-year timeline that we talked about when I first came into office. As you may know, when a new mayor comes in, it's typical to ask all the executives for a letter of resignation. Some you accept, some you don't. I did not accept his. In fact, I asked him if he'd be willing to spend a couple more years in public service because I wanted to get this port project back on track, and I felt he was critical to getting us there. And now we are there. In fact, the $350 million port bond request that we asked for, and the governor has now put a port bond into his legislative package, shows that there's, I think, great confidence that the project is back on track, and Governor Sheffield gets a lot of credit for, over the last 2 years, helping us get to this point.
Sheffield is credited with expanding the Port of Anchorage during his years as director, but critics of the current port expansion project have complained of cost overruns. Sullivan says the former port director will continue to be involved with the port project as a consultant. Current Deputy Port Director Steve Rubufo will be acting director until a replacement is found, Sullivan said. Earlier this month, protesters representing the Occupy movement marched to the port and called for Sheffield to resign. The Alaska Energy Authority has taken the first step in bringing the Susitna-Wautana Hydroelectric Project to reality. Today, pre-application papers were filed with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, which puts the project on a timeline for approval. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The Alaska Energy Authority has filed a pre-application document with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. AEA spokeswoman Emily Ford says the move begins the formal licensing process for the Susitna-Wautana Hydroelectric Project.
It's part of the FERC licensing process, and essentially this is part of our pre-application, so this isn't even the application for the license itself.
Ford says the filing sets the clock ticking on a 6-year timeline.
So this begins a series of milestones and deadlines established by FERC, and also a series of opportunities to engage with the public and stakeholders to make sure that we're developing the right project.
The project calls for a 700-foot high dam to be located on the Susitna River at Mile 84. It will create a 39-mile-long lake. Today's announcement indicates that the dam will be either a concrete gravity or a rock-filled construction. Ford was not immediately clear on how the type of dam would affect the total cost of the project, which is expected to produce between 600 and 800 megawatts of power for the rail belt.
What they'll do is approve this document, and then our next major step will be developing the study plans. And then we'll also have to file the study plans with FERC this spring, and there'll be a time for public comment and outreach there. And then FERC will have to approve those, or we'll have to submit an amended plan. So that's really the next milestone.
Ford says FERC has the final say on the progress of the dam project. But rumblings against the dam are starting to come out of the Susitna Valley. Becky Long represents the Coalition for Susitna Dam Alternatives.
We basically think that there are better alternatives for the rail belt than to build this massive dam. We think that it is an ecological and economic disaster that is waiting to happen.
Long says 6 years is not enough time to adequately examine the impacts of such a project on wildlife and the environment.
The 6 years is not correct. I mean, in terms of undergoing the studies, actually, they really only have 2 years. When you consider the public process, I mean, it takes about a year for the resource agencies to make their decision on what kind of studies need to be done. Then they need to submit that to FERC. FERC makes a decision. And then, of course, you know, with our short seasons here, you know, there's not a whole lot of time in the summer to do studies.
Long also claims that studies regarding impacts to clean water, tidal areas, or water degradation issues will not be adequate. Current estimates of the cost of the dam project are $4.5 billion, although project supporters say that that figure could change. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
An Aleutian volcano that lies on a major international flight path has erupted. Cleveland Volcano sent up a 15,000-foot ash cloud early this morning. The Alaska Volcano Observatory has been keeping tabs on Cleveland since July, when a lava dome in its crater started to grow. There are no seismic instruments on the volcano, so the observatory relies on satellite imagery to monitor it. Geophysicist Cheryl Siri says this is a relatively minor explosion that shouldn't affect air traffic.
Right now, it looks like it was a pretty small, isolated event.
But the observatory is continuing to monitor for further eruptions. In the past, Cleveland has sent up plumes of well over 20,000 feet, which is generally considered the alert threshold for aviation. The volcano lies on a major flight path, and when it erupted in 2001, it sent an ash cloud up to 39,000 feet, disrupting international air travel. The volcano is on an unpopulated Chuandaidak Island. The nearest community is Nikolsky. Nikolsky resident Doris Komkoff says most people didn't even know the volcano exploded until the local air carrier told them. The ash cloud is moving south-southeast and isn't expected to pass over Nikolsky or Unalaska. The Anchorage girl who was injected with heroin by 26-year-old Sean Warner died just after noon today. The Anchorage Police Department has identified the 14-year-old girl as Jenna Dolstad. APD spokesperson Anita Schell says APD's homicide unit will be working with the district attorney's office to review the charges against Warner. There are currently four charges against him, but Schell says more may be forthcoming. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, logistics for the Nome fuel delivery.
We're going to be monitoring and watching this very closely before the tanker arrives until the time that it's ready to depart.
And that's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Vitus Marine, the company contracted to help get fuel delivered to Nome, is hoping to hear back tomorrow on the status of the Jones Act waiver for the Russian tanker Renda. The waiver is necessary for the tanker to be able to load gasoline in Dutch Harbor. Mark Smith, CEO of Vitus Marine, says the Defense Department and Maritime Administration have weighed in to Customs and Border Protection, who ultimately makes the decision. The waiver claims that Nome's fuel is of indirect significance to national security. Alaska's congressional delegation has sent a letter urging the government to approve the waiver. Meanwhile, the tanker is headed toward port. Smith says the Renda was 340 miles southwest of Attu this morning. It's expected to be in Dutch Harbor by the afternoon of June 2nd. Several questions remain on the final routing and offloading of the fuel, but the regulatory pieces are starting to come together. On Tuesday, Vitus submitted its delivery plans to be approved by the state, filing an amendment to its oil discharge prevention and contingency plan to incorporate the cold weather considerations. The vessel support plan is unique, as ice-capable tugs and spare barges will not be on hand. Instead, the Healy will assist, and land-based tanks will provide space in the case of an emergency. The Renda itself is ice-capable, but the State Department of Environmental Conservation is requiring the Healy's participation. The plan calls for staging of skimmers, thousands of feet of boom, pumps, sorbent pads, tank trucks, and a bobcat. Vitus has contracted with Shadow Corporation to have spill response equipment on hand. There will be a spare 610,000-gallon tank available for emergency use even after the fuel is transferred. John Cotola is the manager of the Marine Vessel Section for the Department of Environmental Conservation. He says the agency now is making sure that the plans and resources will be ready.
Through this review process, we will ascertain whether all that equipment is in Nome, and if it isn't, we will have it pre-staged there for the equipment that has to be kept warm to be operational in warm standby, and with a plan to get it out and put it into use if it were needed.
Additional logistics plans are in place for lightering and monitoring the transfer hose if it goes across the ice. The Renda will have extra environmental protection on board, plus three extra officers for a crew of 21. The document says Crowley has agreed to lend equipment in Nome should it be needed. And in addition to the Healy, the plan calls for the Coast Guard to supply a helicopter on shore with C-130 support overhead, plus specialty personnel. Cotula says the state is in communication with private industry and government groups to make sure the pieces come together in the plan.
They will have to have all of the equipment and personnel available if they were needed, and we're going to be monitoring and watching this very closely before the tanker arrives until the time that it's ready to depart.
Vitus CEO Mark Smith says he's confident in the plan. He says it's based in part on what happens on the North Slope on a regular basis. The oil spill response plan is out for public review until January 3rd. This year, the Environmental Protection Agency started their assessment of the Bristol Bay watershed, something tribal entities concerned about the development of the proposed Pebble Mine had requested. KDLG's Daisha Eaton has this update on how the assessment is going and what we can expect in 2012.
Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Rick Parkin is managing the assessment of the Bristol Bay watershed. He says a draft of the assessment could be available as early as spring 2012. But before that, the EPA is rounding up scientists to form a peer review panel.
So in 2012, the very first thing that will be happening is we will publish a Federal Register notice requesting input from folks on expert scientists who should be nominated for our peer review panel. There will be notices on our website.
Nominations will be accepted in January. The purpose of the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment is to gather baseline information about the ecosystems of the Bristol Bay region and to determine how the development of mining might impact the region. Of particular concern are the commercial and subsistence salmon fisheries. The assessment is a response to a request by tribal entities that the EPA look into possible impacts of the development of the proposed Pebble Mine. Parkin says a draft of the assessment is set for publication in April.
In April, the draft will be published. Then, mostly in May, there will be public meetings in Anchorage and then three additional ones out in the watershed. And then, probably in May or early June, we would have that meeting with the peer review panel. That would be a public meeting. That will probably be in Anchorage. And then, in August or September, we would publish the final.
So far, EPA officials have made several trips to the Bristol Bay region to gather information for their assessment. Parkin.
Well, I've been out there five times, I think. Dennis McLaren, our regional administrator, has been out twice. We brought executives from Washington, D.C. out there for an extended trip. With Dennis and the executives from Washington, D.C., we went to visit the Pebble site. And then we had public meetings in New Halen, Equauk, Neustruihoc, and Dillingham We also visited Kilegenek and Iliamna.
Parkin says administrators met with members of each community and got a sense of their concerns. The main topic was balancing the subsistence way of life with creating jobs that provide cash.
In Bristol Bay, the wilderness does put food on the table, and it's the key to their way of life. We also learned that a cash economy is still very important to them. Subsistence is not a poor person's way of life. It's an expensive way of life, and the cost of living in Bristol Bay is enormous. In a lot of the communities that we visited, their concerns are about their cash economy and their jobs. And they look forward that industries such as the mining industry could bring jobs to their communities.
Parkin says he's grateful to all the people who've been sending the EPA information that will inform their assessment of the Bristol Bay watershed. And he says the deeper EPA administrators dig into the assessment, the more they realize it's about a lot more than the proposed Pebble Mine.
Frankly, it's not just about Pebble. We think that there's potential for a number of mines up there. There's quite a large number of exploration activities happening right now. Big chunk, part of it is west of Pebble and part of it is northwest of Pebble. And then Humboldt, which is way down by Kilegenek. I think it's also called Kemik Mountain. And so the likelihood that we're talking about a mining district, I think, really spells out the need to take a look at what the impacts could be.
Parkin says the entire process could be wrapped up in 2012, with publication of the assessment followed by a timely decision on whether to invoke 404C of the Clean Water Act in late 2012 or early 2013. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A new series of reports from the Alaska Healthcare Commission look at the high cost of healthcare in Alaska. Private health insurance premiums are about 30% higher here than in comparison states. The report points to lots of potential reasons for the higher costs, but one surprising finding was the high profit margins for Alaska's urban hospitals. APRN's Annie Feit has the story as part of our series on healthcare costs in Alaska.
Alaska's urban hospitals are very healthy businesses. According to the Healthcare Commission reports, on average, their profits in 2010 were 16.2%. The nationwide average for the same year is 6.3%. Dr. Noah Laufer spent the last year as a member of the Healthcare Commission. He's a primary care physician in Anchorage. He says hospital profits received a lot of attention in commission discussions.
I think it's a truth-finding mission, at least for now. A lot of raised eyebrows, a fair amount of resistance, as you can imagine, from hospitals. But I think what we're doing is getting a more realistic overall picture of what's going on.
The hospital with the largest profit, according to the report, was Alaska Regional in Anchorage. Their 2010 profit is listed at 29%. To put that number in perspective, the historical average profit for Fortune 500 companies is less than 5%. Alaska Regional disputes that figure. CEO Annie Holt says because Regional is run by a nationwide company, the report did not account for the cost of services provided by the owner, Hospital Corporation of America, or HCA. But even factoring that in, the figure Holt comes up with is still nearly three times higher than the national average.
About 15 to 17%.
Does that seem like a high profit margin?
I can't really answer that because I haven't studied what it looks like nationally recently. I was told that it would be comparable to our colleagues here in the Alaska market.
Holt makes the case that the company pays millions of dollars in taxes to the city and state, and she argues that having a big corporation behind the hospital allows them to be very competitive on price.
Many of the functions that are required for a hospital to run are actually handled electronically at our corporate or regional office. So we do keep our costs down here at Alaska Regional.
Hospital profits are an important part of the healthcare cost picture because about one-third of total healthcare spending goes to hospitals. Profit margins for hospitals in Alaska vary widely, according to the report. In general, rural hospital profits are much lower than in the urban areas. Two hospitals, Cordova Community Medical Center and Providence Valdez Medical Center, recorded a loss for 2010. In Anchorage, Providence Hospital had a profit of about 13% last year. Providence is a nonprofit, so CEO Bruce Lamoureux says all of that money stays in the state.
In the case of Providence, Alaska, those margins are used in this community for the benefit of community health.
For 2010, Providence says it spent more than $50 million for community benefit. Lamoureux says there are a number of factors that drive hospital profits up in urban Alaska. A high occupancy rate is one of them. There aren't many idle beds. High Medicaid reimbursements is another. Alaska has generous Medicaid reimbursement rates. But Lamoureux says everyone in the healthcare industry knows that belt tightening is coming, and Providence is working on programs to address that.
We can deliver better care, and we think in the long run that is not only morally the right thing to do, but it better prepares us for a future state where we better get better at managing costs.
The top executive at the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, Karen Perdue, agrees that hospitals in Alaska will need to do more with less in the future. But she says there's a lot more to managing costs.
I think the way to eliminate costs in hospital care is to keep people out of the hospital and to keep them from coming back into the hospital. Can hospitals be more efficient with the money they get? Yes. And should they try? Absolutely.
And Perdue points out that the majority of hospitals in Alaska are making profits that are in line with or below the national average. After spending many hours poring over the reports and discussing the data, Dr. Laufer from the Healthcare Commission comes to this conclusion.
I'm not opposed to having healthy, robust hospitals, but I would prefer to see a system that rather than focusing on growth, is focused on sustainable, good health care for all of us.
That's the goal of the Healthcare Commission as well. The hope is these reports start a dialogue on the issue that will eventually lead to some solutions. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska is one of 23 states to share $296.5 million in federal payments for encouraging low-income families to enroll their children in public health programs. The bonuses were announced Wednesday. They are the government's way of rewarding states that streamline eligibility for Medicaid, the federal state health program for the poor. The Denali Kid Care Office carries out the streamlining and simplification of enrollment policies in Alaska. The state has made several improvements to streamline children's healthcare enrollment recently, including not requiring parents to appear for face-to-face interviews, which can be difficult for working parents. The state will get $5.66 million for its efforts to increase enrollment of children in public health programs. The money will go back into those programs. This is the third year that Alaska has received the performance bonus.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, which has been providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Premera.com. Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at Doyon.com.
University of Alaska Fairbanks administrators are standing behind a decision to return more than 1,000 union organizing letters. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the university maintains the union letters weren't addressed properly to members of a staff group targeted for organization.
Despite its latest setback, Alaska State Employees Association Local 52 is unlikely to back down from its nearly two-year effort to organize more than 1,600 University of Alaska staffers. That setback would be the university administration's continued support for the UAF Mail Services Center's refusal to deliver some 1,200 letters that Local 52 sent to staff at the Fairbanks campus last month. The mail center determined the letters were undeliverable because they only had the employees' names and a generic university address. UAF spokeswoman Marmion Grimes said Wednesday that university officials are standing by the decision to return the mailers to sender.
We feel like our postal employees made a reasonable interpretation of the law.
Local 52 officials said mailrooms at other campuses around the state delivered roughly the same number of mailers with the same kind of addressing. The union claimed UAF's refusal showed university officials were trying to block the union from organizing, and they demanded they reconsider. University officials said that UAF's mail center is a contract postal station that operates under a different set of regulations than the other campus's mailrooms. Grimes says legal staff confirms that was the right call.
We had our attorneys review the postal regulations to make sure that that was the case, and it was.
Local 52 officials have asked the Alaska Labor Relations Agency to add the mail delivery issue to an unfair labor practices complaint the union filed with the agency in March. An ASEA official says Local 52 will continue its efforts to organize the only university employee group that is not represented by a union. The local must collect at least 300 cards from UAF staff and a total of 800 statewide in order to get the State Labor Relations Agency to call for an election. I'm Tim Ellis in Delta.
This week, APRN and our affiliates across the state have been taking a look back at favorite and significant stories of 2011. Tonight, we start in Nome.
This is Lorelei Kinnean at KNOM Radio in Nome. And my favorite story has to be the most recent. Our community health aides were set to go on strike after not being heard by administration. They really let administration know how valuable they are. And although their actions didn't get national headlines like a fall storm or a fuel issue, what they did was pretty powerful. In Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinnean.
This is Len Anderson with KSKA Anchorage. My favorite 2011 story was the opening of Karlik Manor. Early this month, the first 20 of the city's most at-risk chronic alcoholics living on the streets checked into the former Red Roof Inn. The Karlik, remodeled and now run by RuralCap, is patterned after the Housing First model, where tenants are nudged toward lifestyle improvement as they enjoy safe housing and warm meals. Wilbur Westcoast was among the first to receive a room.
A lot of people are excited, and a lot of people down there doing paperwork to come on in.
The opening culminated over 2 years of stories, beginning when across the city over a dozen street people died from causes related to their lifestyle. Then followed months of agency, task force, safety committee, zoning commission, community council, and assembly meetings. It's a good thing when public concern about its most vulnerable population endures to produce at least a partial concrete solution. So much so that in January, I want to report on how Karlik's clients are doing. Or maybe just visit. I'm Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer at Anchorage, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Ben Matheson in Nome, Daisha Eaton in Dillingham, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. We had year-end reports tonight from Lorelei Kinnean and Len Anderson. APRN's Annie Fight and Josh Edge reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, which has been providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates 4 decades of dependable financing and competitive interest rates for Alaskans. Find out more by asking your lender or real estate professional how Alaska Housing can assist you with buying a home. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.